On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other fine publications. This episode is supported by TomTom, AI-ready location intelligence that insurers can trust. With validated map and traffic insights for sharper pricing, smarter claims, and agentic workflows. Learn more at tomtom.com/insuretech. Our guest today is James Benham, an insurance thought leader, entrepreneur, technologist, TEDx speaker, podcaster, and pilot. Maybe we'll have time to talk about all that, James. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So take us back to your early days. By the way, it was nice to meet you at Risk World. We had a couple laughs. There was something you brought up that I did want to get to at the very end, which is the F3 Fitness and Leadership Community, which is kind of a personal thing. But I think it's something we might share with the listeners, and they might take something away from that one. But we'll get to that later. So early years, how did you get to where you wanted to be an entrepreneur? How did this all happen?
Well, you know, I grew up in an entrepreneurial house. My dad was a serial bootstrapped entrepreneur, started a few companies out of his garage, and then the fourth one built up to the third or fourth largest Teflon producer in North America. He's an electrical engineer by training. The Navy taught him about electrical engineering, and then Louisiana State University gave him a degree in electrical engineering. And then he went into making electronic components, and then he went into servicing electronic components for healthcare. And then when I was born, he started a Teflon company. So I grew up walking the manufacturing room floor with him, sweeping floors, looking at machines, talking about business. And for him, everything was a business lesson all the time. And so it was great. And his siblings, you know, who they all grew up just dirt broke, poor Southwest Mississippi farmers. And his three sisters and his brother, all entrepreneurs, all ran their own businesses. So, I mean, I grew up with it. My mom's side was the opposite. You know, my mom's dad was a Navy pilot and retired from the Navy, then worked for the state of Louisiana, retired from that. And, you know, my kind of everybody in that family was all, you know, employees. But you know, growing up with that many aunts, uncles, and your dad, you learn, especially with a dad like mine who was constantly teaching me. So when I was 12, I went to my dad. I'm like, man, I need some money. And my dad wouldn't, I mean, he wouldn't pay for anything. he bought clothes, reasonable ones and a limit, you know, a tight budget on Christmas. I mean, he was tight fisted. And I was like, I need some money. He goes, well, you need to go make it. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm starting a lawn business. Can I use your lawnmower? He goes, nope. He goes, I'll lend you money for a lawnmower. Then you can pay me back. And then once you pay me back, then you can start making money, which is what I did. Bought an Aaron's lawnmower in 1991 or 92. And that was my first business. And then in 96, the internet had come out and I started teaching people how to get on the internet, because that was actually hard at the time. Mm-hmm. I would configure their computers and then teach them, and made really good money at that. I mean, I was 16 making $40 an hour. Doing that.
That's good.
Which was great. I was ecstatic. You know, minimum wage was like $4 an hour at the time. So that was great. And then I went to Texas A&M, the world's finest institute of higher education. And I went to the Corps of Cadets, and I originally was like, man, I'm going to go in the Marine Corps. And I did a bunch of ROTC stuff for 4 years in the Aggie Corps, not the Marine Corps. And just the stars aligned in other places for me. I did a couple of internships with Price Waterhouse as an auditor. Got a degree in accounting, got a master's in business, and went to my dad before I graduated. I'm like, man, I can't do this. I can't go to work for these guys. I want to start a business. Will you be my partner? I need a few thousand bucks, $5,000 to get started. And so he and I, you know, he was a passive partner. He gave me advice every day, called me twice a day, you know, told me what to avoid. He was still running his Teflon company at the time. And so I built up this company. It's been 25 years now, 25 years and 1 month to the day now, of running a software company. And 22 of those years has been in insurance, building software for insurance carriers and TPAs and brokers and admins. And so it's been a fun ride. I love entrepreneurship. When I sold one of my companies in 2018, SmartBid, I wrote a book on it called Be Your Own VC. 10 bootstrapping principles, generate cash and keep control, just to try and preach the mantra of bootstrapped entrepreneurship.
Yeah. You know, it's something, I think there's something in the genes. My dad was a entrepreneur. He was an architect, engineer, city planner. He worked for the man a couple of years and he had to do his own thing again. Like, he, you know, working for the man is a different deal. My father-in-law, while it's not a blood relative, was also, he was an independent health insurance agent, but he worked for the man, real estate and stuff before that. Couldn't do it. I tried it. You tried it. It just, I don't know. It part of it might be a blend of ego, arrogance, confidence. All, you know, there's good and bad qualities that come with it. But you kind of, you see the, you. I don't know how many meetings I've been in where I'm like, I don't know whether this guy knows what he's doing. Like the boss or bosses, the boss's boss even. And so you kind of get frustrated. So in the time I've known you, which isn't a lot, but I get the sense that, yeah, working for the man was not in the cards for you.
No, you know, I was the only intern at the time in my office of Price Waterhouse that sold work for the company. Like, I actually, at lunch, I would go network. I was at an airline, a major airline, and I would go have lunch with all the airline people, not the Price Waterhouse people. And I networked enough that they asked me to go do work for their division. So I sold a new engagement as an intern, as a 21-year-old intern. And I loved it. I loved selling and I loved going over there and working on it. I mean, I enjoyed that. And then, but I also got reprimanded multiple times as an intern. I got in trouble. Because it was just like, come on, is this the way we're going to go? And so I was definitely a square peg round hole, with that kind of engagement, and great firm, you know, great firm just wasn't a great firm for me. And I was lucky enough to find, you know, some great co-founders and my dad and my buddy from high school, Sebastian Costa, and they both tolerated my eccentricities and my mood swings and everything else that you have to tolerate with an entrepreneur. And so, yeah, man, it's been a good ride. And I love, you know, fell in love with insurance. Didn't expect that to happen, but totally fell in love with that. And
it's cool.
I built a product line in construction because of insurance. I got introduced to that through insurance construction risk, and, you know, ended up building a really world-class product called SmartBid. We got 250,000 companies to use it. We sold that company in 2018. And so, you know, it's been a neat ride. You know, today we've got a service business and a product business. JBK is our service business. Terra is our off-the-shelf claims and policy core system. And so, you know, it's been enjoyable and keeps me preoccupied and keeps me traveling and scratches my travel bug.
Yeah. Right. So talk about the software company a little bit more, the Terra. What niche are you in, and what are you trying to do to help people?
Yeah, we're trying to radically change the way that people approach their core systems, because even in an AI world, especially in an AI world, you need a system of record, a deterministic system, meaning that you can predict the same outcome every time, right? You need structured data. You need predefined workflows. It's a regulated industry. There's probably 32 core systems on the market right now, and most of them are wildly overpriced, wildly difficult to implement. And, you know, it's not exactly the most modern things on the planet. And so we decided to go after the entry point or the lower to mid-size of the market, rather than say, hey, we're going to build a personal lines core system and go after, you know, Geico and USAA and State Farm and Nationwide. I did kind of the opposite. I'm like, let's go after self-insured funds, self-insured groups, TPAs, and really build a great claim system and a great policy system, make them fully connected, cloud native, AI native, include the kitchen sink, make one simple fee, and then let's disrupt the whole sector and not charge for implementation, not charge for setup, just charge them for utilization. And, you know, because we think that with all the AI tooling that we can do the conversions a lot faster, the setups a lot faster. And we're trying to really rethink this, because there's just such a high failure rate of implementations that people have been burned a lot. And then on top of that, implementations are so expensive, it keeps most SIFs, SIGs, TPAs on their old legacy system when they really should move forward. And so they're stuck with manual processes. And we're like, hey, let's just throw all that out the window. There's no multi-year contracts. We earn the business every month. It's all of our contracts are month to month. There's no setup fee. There's no implementation. It's a lot more like signing up for HubSpot, like a CRM, than it is like signing up for another system.
And this is for comp, right?
Well, we started in comp. We now support GL, commercial property, commercial auto. We have quite a few lines. So now we say for workers' comp and commercial P&C, because it's definitely something where we've expanded what we support there. And our first several clients, you know, had comp, but also had other lines. They had one state, but then they expanded states. Typical thing, right? They're expanding out, and we had to expand with them. And you know, they wanted their partner to go for the ride with them.
Yeah, so it's a highly regulated business, insurance,
yes,
and workers' comp, maybe even more so.
It is.
Is that the reason you chose? Because you started in workers' comp, right? Didn't you? Didn't Terra start there?
Yeah, it did, 100%. And JBK, my first big commercial PNC client was a work comp TPA. And then a work comp carrier, and then we got into, you know, and these are separate companies with separate staffs, just to be really clear. I am CEO of both, but totally different teams,
right?
Totally different legal entities. But you know, I mean, it matters what industry the CEO knows. I know comp better than the other lines, and yeah, I've gotten to know commercial GL, although commercial GL can be anything. I mean, it's And then, you know, commercial property, commercial auto, those are all big problem children for a lot of SIF, SIGs, and TPAs. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely went on that track with JBK, and then also now doing the same thing in Terra, where the team there is going through the lines and states expansion that just naturally occurs in insurance. But I think it's important to do comp well, and here's why. Because workers' comp is, you know, it's pretty different. You can have a commercial auto claim that can be adjudicated in a month. You can have a commercial property claim that can be adjudicated in a month. You can have a GL claim that can be adjudicated in 2 weeks. You know, it can be quick, up and down. A comp claim can last 100 years. I mean, you could be dealing with surviving dependents, the injured worker themselves and surviving dependents. A comp claim can last forever. These are big, complicated, challenging claims. And the same thing on policy. Comp policies are equally challenging. And then you get into like the PEO space, right? Then it gets even more complex because you have master child policies, and you've got, you know, a lot of variability state by state, and comp laws can be wildly different. And so it is a very complicated thing. I've watched a lot of core systems really struggle to do comp well. And so we started ground up zero from scratch to build something that worked really well for comp, and then added the less complex lines afterwards. Staying away from personal lines. I mean, there's enough players in that space. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do this thing really well, but we also wanted to do it affordably. And that, I think that's what makes it different, is we're actually trying to make it reasonably priced for people to come in. If you have a startup MGA and you don't want to spend a few million dollars on a core system, you only got 5 claims and you got 100 policies, right? You know, we'd like to meet them where they're at.
Yeah. What's the right phrase I'm looking for? You're not looking to disrupt any part of the distribution channel, right? With what you're doing, you're just supporting you're the plumbing supporting the workflows and bringing efficiency to what is otherwise pretty inefficient, historically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you're talking about disrupting disruption, distribution, typically people, when they say that, are talking about disintermediating brokers, right? Mm-hmm. And that is definitively not in our playbook. Mainly because I've watched most people that are trying to do that,
especially fail.
I mean, you know, especially in personal lines, they tend to fail. I mean, the fact that like Lemonade still can't make money should be telling, you know. At what point are you going to hold the carrier accountable for making money? And so, you know, that's the challenge. I think I've watched a lot of people try to disrupt distribution unsuccessfully, and in commercial lines, the brokers have these deep, long-standing relationships with the CEOs and the head of risk for their clients, and so it's challenging to go in and preach, hey, we're going to disintermediate a trusted consultant that has deep personal relationships with the executives of the buyer. Like, really? Yeah. Are you really? Are you really? And they're like, you know, you can't be everything to everybody. You can't provide all lines, which means they still are going to have to buy multiple policies, and it's a pain in their butt, and they're willing to, you know, I use a broker at JBK, man. I got 280 people, and you know, we got complex commercial lines and cyber and GL property commercial. I mean, we got all that stuff, and I don't want to not use a broker. So, I mean, our stance on that is that we'd love to make interactions with brokers a lot easier. I want to make it so they don't have to use an RPA bot to crawl our site to do a submission, right? Like, mm-hmm. I want to pre-integrate with their systems. I want to make it easy. I want to facilitate distribution through the broker channels. I want to be a good partner to brokers. I want to make appointments and terms super easy. I mean, all those things are all high priorities, but definitely disintermediating people is not in that case. Not in that case. There's other parts of the supply chain that need to be disintermediated, but we don't, you know, not them.
Uh-huh. Okay. So looking down the road at what AI and technology in general is offering to us, do you see a world where the traditional insurance company becomes almost obsolete? And I say that because so many of them that are not specializing, like somebody said to me once that niches are riches, and you've set out, you know, starting in work comp, certainly that is that's a very large niche. It's actually a series of niches within a big niche. But I think I feel like there's 2,200 insurance companies in the United States that are rated by AM Best Company. It's a lot. A lot of them kind of look and feel the same. By the way, I'm asking this question of a lot of our guests because I want to, over time, maybe I could actually write a paper on this because I think they're in trouble if they're not already specializing. And many have made the move. Along with that question is the fact that there's incredible growth in wholesale side of business, program administrators, MGAs, you mentioned, as well as captives, captive insurers, insurance programs, and also a lot of smart brokers and all the people I just mentioned going directly to reinsurance, for example, and alternative kinds of reinsurance. The whole thing is sort of evolving in my mind. But yet, if you talk to most independent agents and brokers, they're still dealing with a traditional insurance company, for the most part, for at least standard lines of insurance, including comp. So where's it all headed, James? I mean, I know it's a series of questions and more of a soliloquy. I just feel like there's so much money running through this system. So much running through the plumbing of what is the insurance industry that there's all kinds of opportunities. And it's not just disrupting people, it's disrupting entire models. Anyway, I'll pause there. Does any of that resonate? Do you have a take on it? And please argue against it if you feel that way.
Well, you didn't make a statement that I could argue against. It was a series of statements. So, considering the lack of a definitive statement to argue against, what I will say is that I do agree that the riches are in the niches. I talk about that in my book, in particular, because it's very hard to be a master of all trades. You can't be, and so, you know, jack of all trades. You want to, the saying, jack of all trades, master of none, and you don't want to be that. Right, you want to be a master of something. You want to be really, really good. Yeah. I think MGAs provide a wonderful opportunity for carriers that have excess capacity to help people lay off more risk. I think that I think risk transfer is alive and well in 2026. I think that the need for risk transfer is still just as prevalent as it was 3,500 years ago when the ancient Babylonians did bottom rate contracts. Right, and they sold risk transfer through a premium on the interest rate on the loan if the ship sank. And it's the same reason that we keep doing it today, is that a lot of commerce doesn't happen if there's no ability to transfer your risk. Plain and simple. You know, it just becomes untenable to do what you want to do because you can't transfer risk. I would not fly airplanes as a pilot if I didn't have the ability to get coverage. The risk is too high, and so that's why it's really important. So I do believe that in an AI world, risk transfer will be alive and well. Mm-hmm. I believe that the companies that engage in risk transfer, many of which will be alive and well, especially the ones who embrace technology, cloud computing, and AI, because they'll have a leg up in predicting outcomes, which is what the whole dang industry is about. It's about assigning a cost to predict an outcome, right? Mm-hmm. We're seeing evolutions in that. We're seeing stuff like Polymarket and Kashi that come out that allow people to really functionally bet. And you know, you've got a narrow difference between betting markets and insurance markets, right?
Yeah. I mean,
really fine. Or to quote the everything for me is a musical, so it's you know, there's a fine line, that there really is a fine line between betting and insurance. You know, in insurance, you actually have to have the asset or the risk, whereas in betting, you can just bet on whatever you want, right? And so, in both cases, though, you know, you have people trying to assign a probability to an outcome, and then they're assigning a cost to that probability, and so I think that's alive and well. I think data gives us the ability to rate individual assets, individual people, individual cars, individual companies much, much more precisely than rating than just rating everybody on the same and you know, making your money on the average. You can say, hey, look, you know, this, you know, we now have enough data to pull your entire driving record, your entire personal history, all your stuff, and you're not a good risk. So you want insurance, you're going to pay more. Right. And in the past, before we interconnected all these systems, you know, the submarines were truly underwater and you didn't know which one had a nuclear ballistic missile on it, right? Mm-hmm. And now you have a much better idea. So I think all of that means that we'll still have MGAs. I think MGAs are great because they give carriers the chance to deploy their capital and deploy excess capacity without screwing up their core business model. I think that's really nice. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to create the new policy system and the new claim system and create all 10 data feeds. I mean, a lot of it's an IT issue, you know, mm-hmm. And the other part of it is that it messes up their core pricing for their core clients. And so I think it gives room to experiment. I think that captives, you know, as you see markets harden in different areas, captives, you know, because captives and self-insured groups, SIGs, SIFs, and captives, they go in and out of popularity based on how hard the market is and how high premium gets and how available different stuff gets. And so you're, you know, whenever things get real hard for even getting coverage or the prices are too high, it's a perfect scenario for captives and SIGs to form. Mm-hmm. Then when it gets really soft, then all the major markets pile in all those SIGs and SIFs that have all that, which is what you're seeing right now with work comp, because work comp is one of the only big profitable lines. Right. Whereas before it was the line nobody wanted to write.
Yeah. So what, let's talk about leadership if you don't mind. And by the way, I got your book on my desk here. Thank you for giving me one. I'm halfway through it. It's a good reminder of the need to have both your right brain and left brain working when you're approaching these issues. You know, you need a healthy dose of both. The emotional and rational side of whatever you're doing, and I think that I'm reminded of that when I talk about or ask about leadership. What is your philosophy about leadership? What is your core leadership philosophy?
Well, first, it helps to define leadership. Right? Leadership is motivating ordinary people to do extraordinary things. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Management is managing individual people, tasks, and projects to completion, right? Leadership is setting a vision, motivating people, accomplishing things that are harder than the individuals themselves on their own could do it. That's at a heart, that's what leadership is. And so I've always been taught that number one rule of leadership is taking care of your people. That doesn't mean that you take it easy on everybody. You can still be a demanding leader, but you got to make sure that you're paying attention to the people underneath you and that you're feeding their emotional needs, right? Like, do you understand the vision that we have? Do you understand where we're headed? Do you understand what we're doing? And you understand why, right? And that's why I love Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why. Really a great thesis for why you have to look at why you're doing things. You know, why does a company exist? And then why is it doing the things it's doing? Why do you exist? Why are you doing those things at the company? Because when you find the motivation, then you can really tap into something deeper and get people to really connect and give more than just the minimum to keep a job. And so that's, To me, that's what it is. It's taking care of people, setting clear vision, and motivating them to do extraordinary things. And then, you know, being a good cultivator of talent. Great leaders, like the best leaders, cultivate more leaders. And so that's why I'm always really proud when I see, you know, young ones coming through our organization and turning into leaders themselves under the tutelage of a guy that I trained, who then trained another guy, who trained another guy or girl, who then trained another one. Mm-hmm. Like right, our current generation of upcoming leaders is like five generations back from me and the first lessons I taught to now.
Yeah.
And so it's really neat to see that generational landscape over 25 years as a not young guy anymore. You know, I was 21 when I started this, and now I'm 46. I'm definitively middle-aged. and you know, it's, you can see that the guy that you mentored and the girl that he mentored and the guy that she mentored and the girl that he mentored, you know, five generations down, still carry the same things. And that core thing has got to be your core values. We have six of them, you know.
Tell me about
it's an acronym, DBSTHE, do the right thing even when no one's looking, be self-motivated and resourceful, show respect to everyone, be a JBK ambassador 24/7, think lean, have each other's backs, and enjoy the ride and geek out. And our people are expected to know them, memorize them, repeat them. And we use it in hiring and firing and management, promotions, because if they're not a right values fit, then we can't even work with them.
Yeah.
And you know, different companies have different value sets. So if you look at the value set of Ferrari, right, which was really driven around the ego and the brilliance of Enzo Ferrari, it's wildly different than Walmart, which was driven by Sam Walton, who drove the same red truck, which I got to see when I went to his Walton's Five and Dime in Bentonville. Mm-hmm. Wildly, wildly different core values that got possible to coalesce around them, but both wildly valuable franchises, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's no one right set of core values. It just has to be right for you and be consistently applied, be KBA, FBA, known by all and followed by all. If it's not, it's not a set of core values. And so, you know, that's where leadership and, you know, culture is expressed in values, and then how those values are used, that creates culture. And then it's also expressed in the daily practices of how you treat people. And that's when people talk about culture. That's what they're talking about, is the values and the expression of those values. When we talk about leadership, they're talking about vision, clear vision. And then, you know, management is traction, right? So you have vision, and then you have traction, and then you have health, like how people get treated. Those are the core pillars. Gino Wickman laid that out brilliantly in his book that established the business methodology EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System, which we follow. And so I think that's important guidance.
It is. I think all those people you mentioned, I'm a big fan, particularly of Simon Sinek. Great TED Talks. If anybody, if you don't want to read his book, Start With Why, you can see him doing TED Talks. But that's the crux of it, like building the brand from the inside out, starting with the people, starting with your values. That's really good. It's funny, we do a lot of work with different companies around core values. The difference between, you mentioned those two companies that were so different, even within the insurance industry, you can have vast differences. And I was talking with an HR lead at a New York City-based big insurance company, and he said, you know, we have a sink or swim mentality here. Like if we see you swimming, we throw more bricks at you, you know. So it's like that may not work in other parts of the country if you're going to be inundated with more bricks. But the challenge in New York is still a little bit different than the challenge in some parts of the country where there's other kinds of values, like say Midwest values. But yeah, use those to hire, use those to fire, use those to promote people. It's a great. I'm glad to hear you talk about the core values. Let me ask you the myth. Insurance industry, I'm on a couple of boards designed to get younger people into the insurance industry, James, and starting in high schools and community colleges. You mentioned the younger generation. Gen Z, I think, is 14, age 14 to 30. They're the ones who are coming into the industry in droves, or should be, because it's a great industry. We all know that. As a tech guy, it sounds like you know quite a bit about your customers, about the insurance industry. What's a myth about the industry that drives you crazy?
About the insurance industry or the tech industry?
Insurance industry.
I think one of the big myths about the industry in general is that it makes money no matter what. Because yeah. It definitely doesn't. There's definitely times when the insurance industry loses money in spades. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a general perception that, you know, insurance makes money no matter what all the time. And I'm like, no, it does not. I can definitely point to clients of mine that went bankrupt. I can point to carriers that got a business and TPAs that got me. It is a harder business than people think. They're like, well, no matter what, you make your premium, and no matter what, you're okay. And the insurance company is the house, and the house always wins. I'm like, no, it doesn't. I mean, it's just look at the Florida property market in the last 5 years, and you'll see the graveyard of a few brands that no longer exist. So I think that's probably the one that irritates me the most. The other one is kind of a self-reinforced internal myth from insurance, that insurance is slow to adopt new tech. And that's just historically not true. Insurance was an early adopter on mainframes and computerized record keeping and software and databases. I mean, if you want to see an industry that's slow to adapt, I'll take you to construction, and then we'll see an industry that still has half the companies there using paper or bare bones Excel spreadsheets, right? And in insurance, you've got decades. In fact, we actually have an innovator's dilemma in insurance. We have the opposite problem. The industry adopted mainframes and core systems really early, and now we have the burden. Yeah. We have the burden of legacy of these old systems that are hard to migrate off of. So we have an opposite problem. So that's probably the two things that irritate me. That, and they'll say, well, you guys just play golf all the time. I'm like, hell no, man.
Who's got time for that?
Maybe some personal line, or maybe some commercial lines brokers play a lot of golf, but maybe they're like 20-year producers who've been doing this a long time, and they only have a few accounts that they deal with. Maybe. But honestly, like, production targets are so hard at most places that's just not really the case. I mean, the folks I know in insurance work pretty hard. And so I know that I do. I mean, I work more hours now than I did as a 22-year-old. So it's, you know, maybe it's enjoyable. Yeah. So I think that's
if you love what you do, it's not work, right?
It does not. I'll be honest with you. It does not feel like work for me. Mm-hmm. I wake up and my brain just goes straight back to it. And, you know, I spend time with my children. I do. I spend time with my fiance. I spend time with, you know, the people that matter to me. I spend time with them. I still get time with them. And like my hero, my mentor, who I released a YouTube series on, was a guy named Skip Brechtel, a legend in work comp. And he passed away last February of 2025 from cancer. And he worked until about 2 weeks before he passed away. Maybe a week and a half. Like I think 14 days before he passed away, he was doing a presentation, like a stewardship on oxygen. Like he had oxygen cannula in his nose. And I was like, what are you doing? And he goes, James, there's only so many times you can say sorry to all your loved ones and your friends. He goes, I love this. This is fun. It's enjoyable. I'm going to do it every minute I can. I'm going to hand off all my projects in the best shape I can. And that's why I watched it. And again, he took plenty of time for vacations. He played golf every week, once a week on the weekends. Yeah. But he played golf every week. He hung out with his wife all the time. He hung out with his kids. He had a robust personal life, and he still had a passionate work life, and he managed to I don't really kind of believe there's work-life balance. I think it's a pendulum that you kind of swing, but he rode the pendulum well, and he went out the way he wanted to go out, and that's kind of how I want to. You know, I'd like to work until the moment I can't.
Because
it's fun, it's enjoyable, it gives you purpose, it gives me purpose.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a life-work balance, but as opposed to work-life. But life first, there's a lot of, I don't know, maybe I would have the luxury of being able to say that now, but I think I work more now than I ever did. Before, I put a lot of time into commuting, because work used to be a place we went to, if you remember those days. Now it's just a thing we do. Like you're in your studio, I'm in my studio, where doesn't matter where we are. technology disrupts time and space, and here we are. We're recording something. It's unheard. You know, we were in the car, my wife and I, and Ellen orders a pair of Adirondack chairs on Amazon where we're going down 95 at about 95, and over Amazon it gets sent that day, dropped that day to my brother and his wife who have a brand new deck in their backyard, so they have the two new Adirondack chairs delivered on a Saturday afternoon. You can't make it up, man. You're just looking at your little phone, which has more computing power, I'm sure you know this, than they did in 69 when they put a man on the moon. It's yep. Unreal what we have now. I think we all take it for granted, right?
I know. And now I have Claude, which has like radically changed my life. And so,
yeah,
you know, it's really neat. It's really neat the tools we have at our disposal and where we have them and when we have them. And, you know, it does allow you to chase more down. It's fun.
All right. So in the time we have left, which isn't much, I want you to tell me about an early failure in your career that was the best thing that ever happened to you.
I had a few of them. I had a few of them that almost put me out of business. You know, I remember the worst day I had in the first 10 years of business was January 14th, 2008. Mm. I had a employee that was not paying attention to his job, and he was busy with a side hustle that he didn't disclose. And, you know, he ignored some really important things that were going on with our servers and, cause he was busy looking at other stuff. Mm. And, you know, and that was challenging, especially when there was a brownout in our data center that caused some internal parts of the hardware to fail. Cause back then it was pre-cloud. We had our own servers and, we had all of our stuff go down January 14th. Everything went down. I lost 5 days of data. Mm. Oh, it was just catastrophic. And I thought the business was over. I thought I was over. I thought, I was going to have to pack everything up. It was terrible. And you know what, it definitely taught me about redundancy, about resiliency, about, you know, enduring hard things. You know, the most important lesson from that was that often when you have a crisis, the only thing you can do is the next right thing. You can't focus on the 10 things you have to do. You have to focus on like the one thing. What is the one thing you can do right that moment? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And that definitely was a hard way to learn that lesson. But I definitely did.
That's good.
Yeah. We managed to navigate that crisis and not lose any customers, and we also, you know, learned a lot from it and decided, okay, we're going to change the way that we operate and the way that we build things. And it was really important. It was a big inflection point for us that resulted in a really long term a much healthier, much better company. And that employee, obviously he didn't stay around. But he and I reconciled a couple of years later, and that taught me about forgiveness both ways. He's a friend of mine to this day. And, you know, it taught me a lot, you know, over that stretch. And that those were, you know, early days. The other one was probably when I discovered insurance. You know, I say discovered, when I discovered it, 2004. That was 3 years into the business, and I realized that I could keep trying to work in all these different industries, or I could just pick one or two and try and be really great.
Yeah.
And you know, it was insurance in 2004, construction in 2006, and then when I sold SmartBid in 2018, I said, you know, two industries is exhausting. I need to be worn out by one, and so I just said, okay, we're all in on insurance. And that was definitely the best move I could have made at the time for my mental health, my ability to focus, my ability to learn more about this amazing industry. And, you know, it was sad to not go to my construction conferences anymore. And I spoke at like 350 construction conferences as a keynote. I really plumbed the depths of that knowledge, but, dialing it in insurance has really been good for JBK, the services company, and for Terra, the product company, and for me personally. And now my podcast and my two companies, everything I do is about insurance, all of it, all the time. That or you know, my hobbies.
Yeah. Well, and the nice thing is, and probably why you got involved in it, James, is that construction insurance are kind of go hand in hand. I mean, it's a huge part of the P&C insurance industry.
Yeah,
and all the aspects of loss control, risk management, taking the fat out of it. Yeah, it's great. A lot of very successful agents and brokers have really good friends in the construction business. The other ancillary part is surety, which is like almost like banking. It's like another. It's different. But man, is there money in surety? Oh my gosh!
There's a lot of money in surety, and I worked very closely with the surety providers back in the day, mm-hmm. and it was really good. We built some really great products around subcontractor pre-qualification that were designed to satisfy the requirements of surety bonds, because surety bonds really changed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, and. Mm-hmm. You know, to get surety and to get sub-default insurance, which are very different products, by the way. Mm-hmm. They both are triggered by a collapse of something, but they're very different. I didn't understand that at the time, but they both need pre-qualification, and that led to a whole lot for us. And yeah, and I get it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're almost out of time. I did mention earlier the F3 Fitness and Leadership Community. Can you talk to that? Because I think, by the way, people can find you obviously on LinkedIn. You have a podcast you mentioned. You got your book called Be Your Own VC. Maybe you have other books. You're everywhere.
No, that's so it. That's it.
People can find you also your company.
JamesBenham.com.
JamesBenham.com. Terra.insure.
Yep.
TRRA.insure. And then yep. JBK.
JBK's website is jbknowledge.com, and then then on LinkedIn just look for James Benham. I should be the number one hit on that one.
Okay.
We were talking about, sorry, what the
it was the F3
So I discovered F3 a few years ago. I discovered it because a friend of mine introduced me to it. It's the biggest company that's not really a company. It's really cool, and it's designed for men. It's really to foster and develop community and male leadership, and it is a support group disguised as a workout group. It meets 6 days a week in open public city parks or on the street. There's no money that trades hands at all. Nobody pays anybody any money. There's over 4,000 locations. And they generally meet at 5:30 in the morning, Monday through Friday, 6:30 in the morning on Saturdays. The workout is 45 minutes long, and you work out together, and then you have kind of where you circle up and just talk about what's bothering you that day.
Okay.
And
that's really good.
It's really cool. F3 stands for fitness, fellowship, and faith. It is not affiliated with any given church. It's just faith in something bigger than yourself. It is a really great organization, and I travel a lot, so I don't always get to go. There are periods when I'll go a month or two without going at all, but it's an amazing community. I've been to F3s all over the country. I've been to my own in my own town. I have one in my neighborhood that meets 5:30 at the local park. It's really cool, and it's cool because no one is getting paid. You rotate who leads the workouts. You share with each other. And I can tell you, going through a divorce would have been a lot harder without that. It's a really neat way to make friends. And because here's why, because men suck at making friends. And
100%.
We just are not good at it. We tend to cling to our college buddies. And even then we tend to not keep up with them very well. And it's just not easy.
It's not healthy.
And we look in, you know, all the wrong places to fill the gap that male healthy male friendships should serve, and accountability with each other. And so it's really a great mission. It's a nonprofit based out of North Carolina, I believe.
Okay.
It started like 14 years ago with six people at a park, and it's turned into like, I don't know, 250,000 men, I think.
That's incredible. It's an app, right? You can get the app.
There's a website called F3 Near Me, but it's F3 Nation is the website.
Okay.
You just go there, and they have a little locator, and you can find out the nearest one to you and what schedule they meet at. But it's cool because – You're not paying anybody, and so you can't whine. You can't complain. Like, if someone leads a workout you don't like, shut up. Just shut up. Right. You're not the customer. You're the member. Yeah. You're the participant. So it's a neat deal, and most guys don't know about it. And if they do, they go, I'm not going to get that up that early, or, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Men need friends. You're 100% right, James. And they always we put on like a tough guy mentality when in fact inside we're humans. And and the best CEOs I've met, the best leaders I've met have a sense of their own vulnerability, and they would get something like this. But a lot of other types are always trying to have all the answers and asking questions. They're afraid to show that they have some weaknesses, as human beings all do.
Yeah.
So I love it. And as men age, it gets even worse, more isolating. That's why suicide is so rampant. You hear about suicides with kids who are tormented by social media, but it happens as men age too. 65 and up, they lose their jobs or retire, and they feel they don't have any purpose. They don't have any context and things to bounce things off of. And so things like that, awesome to hear about it. I appreciate you bringing it up with me at Risk World and talking about it here. So, James, thank you, man. Thanks for your time. Wish you all the best with the companies. I'll see you on the circuit.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.